Welcome back to season 6 of the Reconnected podcast. Today, we're here with music producer, engineer, and studio tech, Mike Madura, at the Cybersound Recording Studios here in Copley Square in Boston, Massachusetts, owned by Perry Geyer.
Mike Madura, as Jerry said before, is producer, engineer, studio tech. Mike Madura is a Berklee College of Music graduate with a degree in music production and engineering. Mike has worked with a wide variety of artists spanning nearly every genre, including pop, hip-hop, alt-metal, singer-songwriter, acoustic folk, and indie rock. Do you like all those genres too? We'll get to that later. Mike has also engineered for artists signed to WMG, Sony Music, and Republic Records. Alongside music, Mike is also an experienced audio editor and voiceover ADR engineer, having worked with companies such as Netflix, Audible, Blizzard, and Dell. In addition to producing and recording, he is Cybersound Studios tech in charge of fixing and maintaining the studio equipment and technology, for which we're very grateful. He uses his talents as a multi-instrumentalist, which is incredible, in various East Coast bands, most notably prog metal outfit Atomic Guava, who have been making waves in the metal scene since 2020. Mike, we are so stoked to have you here with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, Mike, we're so happy to have you. And, in terms of setting the stage for this episode, we want to understand your journey about becoming a music producer and how you got here. We're going to try to understand how you facilitate creating music with artists and bands, and how an idea that someone has in their head can turn into a studio produced album or song, and also what that process looks like, because people hear the music but they don't really know what goes into making music. There's a whole process that people don't really get exposed to, and Mike is a shining example of what it's like to be part of the whole process, because Mike is such a unique producer. He's a musician. He's able to add on different arrangements through the music that he produces himself, with the electric guitar, the bass guitar, the keyboard, the piano, right? All the different aspects that he brings to songs. He's able to do the engineering, which is basically allowing the sound to come in into the song to the highest quality that it can. And he's able to do the mixing and the mastering. There's so much that goes into the production of a song. And it's a very meaningful experience for artists, I think. And I really want to get at that with Mike, is how important it is for artists to be able to produce their own original music. So that's just setting the stage for this episode, why we're doing it and why it's important for people to hear. And I think that we want to start with Mike, with what is your journey getting into this career? Where did it start?
Yeah.
What were you doing when you're 5 years old that led you to get here?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up surrounded by music. My parents, my grandparents were all pretty musical. My grandfather played accordion. My other grandfather played guitar in a jazz band. He actually also went to Berklee back the 60s, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I always grew up around it. Listening to music was super important. My parents would show me all the stuff they listened to, and I really just kind of ran with that.
Yeah.
My mom made me take piano lessons when I was a kid, as much as I really hated it. I owe a lot to that.
Yeah.
Got my first guitar when I was 8 or 9 years old. Started to like it, started to play a little bit, and then, you know, got to middle school and high school, and I was like, oh, other people like this too? Okay, they're good at guitar. Maybe I'll try to get better at guitar too, you know?
I'll stick with this thing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, doing the usual kid stuff, playing drums and the concert band and all that horrible stuff my parents had to listen to in the basement for years. But yeah, kind of through that, I just started joining different ensembles and stuff in high school. Did a lot of jazz, did a lot of marching stuff, symphonic ensembles. So I was a percussionist primarily. But played a lot of mallets, which I really took a liking to. And
wait, I got to pause you right there,
yeah,
because,
sure.
You know, when you watch like bands and marching bands and stuff, especially in high school, I always was drawn to like the people who would like hit those big drums and make those big sounds, because that would reverberate as loud as could be, right? And I was always like, oh, that sounds really cool. And maybe that's like the easiest instrument to play, but I don't think that's actually true. What was your experience with that?
Yeah, I mean, so I never really like marched like a full season playing like bass drum or anything.
Yeah.
I was always in pit, so like I didn't have to move around.
Oh, okay.
So I never had to do drill or anything like that, which honestly, that's to me, that's the hard part is like, I don't know where I have to be standing.
Like the coordination.
Yeah. I just want to stand in one place and just play some stuff.
Yeah.
I played a lot of mallets. And so, you know, whatever time for college applications came around and I was like, oh, I'm going to do computer science. So I'm going to apply to all these places. My parents are like, okay, you have to also apply to music school, which is the opposite of what most parents say. But, you know, they were like, look, all you've done for your entire last 10 years of your life is like play music. So like, please just humor us and like apply to music school.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting. You still do use the computer. You wanted to get into computer science.
Yeah.
And yet so much of what you do involves the computer.
Yeah. And I mean, I've always had, you know, an affinity for technology and computers, so that like it is a pretty natural transition, because even when I was in high school, I would, you know, I bought a few microphones and started recording, even if it was just like me and my friends playing in our like crappy band or whatever.
Yeah.
We wanted to record something, and obviously we didn't have any money, so I was like, oh, I can buy a cheap interface and a cheap old laptop from some guy in a parking lot on Craigslist. True story. And, you know, we can at least put together some demos or whatever.
Yeah.
And even just like from the very beginning with that and messing around with sounds and stuff, I was like, oh, this is really fun. And it didn't even occur to me that I could like make a career out of that until, you know, much later. And so, I applied to Berkeley, did my audition. Vibraphone was my principal instrument.
Wait, what?
Exactly.
Explain that.
So I think it was half, like 50% of the reason for that was it was a really good bargaining chip, because they're like, they like people who play weird instruments. If I auditioned on guitar or drum set, there's 1,000 people that audition on guitar and drum set. But there's only 4 vibraphonists I knew at the whole school.
Wow.
The entire time I was there. So they were like, hey, that's weird, you should come here and we'll help you out. And that was kind of my way in.
That's awesome. Wait, okay. So first of all, very strategic of you.
Yeah.
Second of all, wait a minute. How often do you play the vibraphone now?
So I in high school, I had great immediate access to all kinds of lots of marimba, lots of vibraphone, xylophone, glockenspiel. I had all that crap just in the band room. I could go play whenever I want.
And you mentioned your family played the accordion, which is a unique instrument.
Yeah,
too.
My grandfather, Polish, played the accordion.
Okay.
But I mean, quite honestly, I don't think I've played vibraphone since 2019. I finished my like private lesson track in school, and then I was like, well, I don't have a vibraphone.
Well, I think you need to definitely bring a vibraphone into one of Jerry's next songs, maybe.
if I had $6,000 laying around, I could blow on a vibraphone. I would have one here tomorrow, you know. But
you never know. We're putting it out to the music gods.
Yeah, literally. That'll go. If I can ever afford a house, that's good. That's part of the mortgage. I'll buy a vibraphone.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's really cool, Mike. Okay, so tell us more about your journey at Berkeley and learning how to produce music. And it sounds like, before we even go in that direction, it sounds like all these experiences you had growing up, even though they were diverse and you didn't maybe become like an expert at one thing necessarily, like, oh, I'm the best at this. Like, you had such diversity and you're really good at a lot of things. How do you think that kind of fed into what you do now, producing a wide range of music? Because your genre of what music you produce is pretty wide range as well.
Yeah, I mean, so I would say everything kind of came in little pieces. Like at first I was really, obviously like right when I graduated high school, I was really at the top of my percussion game because I played like 5-6 hours a day.
Mm. Wow.
So that was a really good kind of baseline to jump into everything else. The engineering aspect of it, I had definitely dabbled with it when I was in high school, but obviously I didn't know what I was doing really.
Yeah.
When I got to Berkeley, they gave me a copy of Pro Tools. And of course, I just switched everything I was doing to that because I was like, oh, this is what the professionals use. Whatever you want to say about that. But
Sounds like you have some things to say about that.
I do. Yeah. For another time, maybe. I think the engineering thing came a lot from being in school and like studying it formally. That environment really helped me personally. That was the way I learned really well, was just by having professors who were really knowledgeable teach me how to do things.
Mm.
And a lot of the technical side, I definitely attribute to my like formal Berkeley education. And so the engineering thing was a nice long journey of that 4 years of getting, you know, more fluent in all that. I find the creative flow was a lot different. I had played guitar in high school, whatever. The thing is, when I got to Berkeley, I never wanted to pick up a guitar.
Really?
Because everyone I was surrounded with was a nasty guitar player.
Yeah.
And I had a guitar in my room and I actually put it under my bed because I was like,
really?
If I pick this up, I'm going to embarrass myself.
So it's interesting because I always say when you're surrounded by people who are so good at something, it either pushes you to want to do that mm-hmm. or it pushes you in the other direction to find something else that you do really well to complement whatever's happening.
Right. And that's kind of what happened. Yeah. So my first roommate was, we were randomly placed together. This kid, Matt, he's an incredible guitar player.
Yeah.
Like the most like proficient. He just picks up and plays like it's literally nothing.
Wow.
And I lived with him and we're still good friends. And
I'm always in awe of that.
Yeah. Oh, me too. I literally was from day one. But like subconsciously because of that, I was like, dude, I can't play guitar in front of this kid. Like he's going to, you know, whatever.
So this is interesting too because we've had our cousin Jopi on the mm-hmm. show before and you know him too. And he went to Berkeley for a year. Mm-hmm. And I think he was kind of like, fueled by his opportunity to be creative while around other creatives. But most people who go to Berkeley, from what I hear from the students I've worked with or people I've talked to, they often have a similar path that you have in that they're like, let me learn as much technical stuff as I can while I'm here. Because if you end up doing the performance side of playing music, like at least you know what's going on mm-hmm. in the background versus only being in the creative flow. I don't know.
Right.
I feel like it can go either way. And I'm curious about your experience, especially for anybody who might be interested in pursuing music school in your future who might be listening.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think a good sort of way to think about it is like you want to, at least for me, like the best way that worked for me was like, I want to study the technical stuff and be so proficient in it that it's simply no longer a barrier to creativity.
Yeah.
Like I want to be able, like if someone says, oh, I want a piano right here. 5 seconds, done.
And you do that.
Like, you like,
I've seen you in action. We'll talk about that in a few minutes too. But like you can hear a thing and then create it, which is so cool because mm-hmm. you have that technical stuff mastered.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean that technical stuff just comes from doing it a lot.
Mm.
And as much as I attribute that to school, like being here at working in a studio and, you know, having the opportunity to just drill the same skills over and over and over and over again, whether that's editing audiobooks, recording rappers, recording singer-songwriters, whatever it is, doing the same thing over and over again, you're going to get fast at it.
I'm going to press pause here, Jared, and I want you to chime in because there's such a theme in all of the people you've interviewed and brought on the show who are really great at what they do because they often will highlight, like, I had to just get so good at this technical side of what I do well before I could, like, bring all the pieces together. And it's almost like you shed like an insecurity or like a lack of confidence mm-hmm. when you've like feel so proficient at a thing. But I feel like, and I've said this a million times, so forgive me, audience and you guys, but I have to say it again. I feel like in our world, we skip that phase of things and everybody just wants to jump to being really good at pulling the pieces together. Mm-hmm. But even Shane Sager, who was on this season 6, he was saying the same thing. He's like, I just had to practice and practice and practice and drill myself so I felt good letting things flow and being more creative because I didn't have to draw back to the technical side as much because it was a part of my repertoire.
Yeah, you know what's cool about Mike's story too is he was doing this even when he was a kid. He's like, hey, let's get together and just like make this work. Let's try to, you know, record our music.
Yeah. Literally.
Right. And just jumping into doing it,
Yeah, I think, you know, people like Shane who have that ability to just buckle down and grind something, in a lot of ways, like you're super lucky to have your passion also be something that you like want to do like as a career, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, it's a lot easier to grind something like that when you're like, this is like my job, but I'm also like super into it.
Yeah. Well, that's apparent too.
Yeah.
And I think that's, that's it's a really cool thing. But going back to what you said, Jared, you know, Joe said this too, when we interviewed him, he's like, in high school, like he was like, I was running a band. We would go out to the garage and like, we would have band practice. Mm-hmm. And like some of my friends, they were my friends, but they were also in the band. And they didn't always like me when we were in the band because I'd be like, hey, we got to do this again until it sounds right.
Yeah.
Were you like running court when you were recording back in the day too?
I mean, a little bit. I kind of owe like a lot of my discipline to like doing the scholastic music stuff and like being in like concert band and specifically marching band, because my school, like, we were extremely competitive. We were like a very high ranking school for like marching arts.
You were here in Massachusetts, right?
Yeah. I went to high school in Wrentham, Mass.
Okay.
And we were, we were pretty hardcore about it. Like, we would practice like probably like 20 to 30 hours a week, depending on the season. And like, it was brutal. And so obviously like the educators that I had were very like discipline oriented.
Yeah.
And I obviously I got caught onto that and I was like, oh, look, like if you want to get stuff done, you have to be able to like lock in a little bit.
Yeah. Wait, you dropped the, I did these kind of like more classical training when I was younger and then jumped to Berklee. Can we drill down? Because I'm such a proponent of like arts and education. Mm-hmm. And if you had a great experience with that, or even if you didn't, can you like bring us into a day in the life of what that was like being young? And if you're into computer science, there's like so much, you know, the kids call it today big brain energy you need to bring into that, right? To really like figure that out. But then also to do music at the same time, what was that experience like for you?
I mean, I found like in high school, I was really like, I was like a fine student. I wasn't like straight A's or anything, but you know, I tried as hard as I needed to, kind of get by and not, you know, get in too much trouble. But like just doing all that stuff was like, I mean, whether I knew it or not, it was a really good way to just like keep me out of trouble and just keep me like, you know, occupied with my time. And it was something I really enjoyed doing. It was a great feeling to, you know, get to a performance and get to be a part of something, you know, whether it was like a small jazz band doing a performance or whether it was like 120 people in a marching band doing a performance, like it's a very like satisfying feeling to like get to the end of a season and just get to
let it go.
Just let it go. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's great.
Nice. Do you have any stories you can share about a teacher either at Berklee or your band teacher or your band leader in high school? Just someone that you felt really made a difference in terms of how you learned or just how you went about music?
Great question.
So I think the first person in my like formal education that comes to mind, I had, he was actually taught me like drum lessons when I was in elementary school. And then when I was in high school, he was like the lesson director. His name's Ryan Loud. He's a percussionist. And he was a great teacher. And he had a really great way of like connecting with us and like kind of tailoring what like his education to like what we wanted to do. So like he was a really good drum set player, great vibraphone player, great marimba player. And he actually exposed us to a lot of like different types of music, which is really great. Cause like obviously when I was a kid, I wanted to learn like Rush or whatever. I wanted to play YYZ or whatever. And he's like, yeah, he'll show you how to do that because he's great. And he'll teach you how to do that. But you know, in high school, we were super lucky to have, he actually like studied a lot of like West African and like Ghanaian drumming and stuff.
Wow.
And a lot of like, you know, Afro-Cuban, like Latin music and stuff like that. So he would always like, we had like a world percussion program where
he'd bring
in like different cultures. And I got to play like steel pan growing up, which is like crazy. Who has gotten to do that?
It's
like,
amazing.
It was really, really amazing. And like we owe that to him. And he was really, really like insistent that we are all exposed to all these different types of music. And it was just great.
What do you think that did for you?
I think, you know, it more than just like, obviously like it's making me like a more like worldly person, which like in general was great because he taught us a lot about the culture of the music and stuff, which is super important. But it really like informed my like vocabulary as a musician. And like I like specifically think about kind of like the West African stuff and like a lot of like the rhythms and things that like I would spend like hours and hours doing like when I was in high school. Like still to this day, like I find myself just like, you know, I'm tapping on a desk or whatever. It's just like, it's just like ingrained in me for some reason. And it really just like, it really helped my like growth as a musician.
It's so interesting because, you know, I'm thinking about how like growing up with music in our family and in our household, as you said, and Jerry and I most certainly grew up with a lot of music around us, But in a lot of other cultures, especially in the African cultures, like music and dance and rhythm mm-hmm. is a part of like everything they do and yeah. so many traditions. And to be immersed in that, I always imagine it as it's like, it's in their DNA, it's in their veins,
yeah, yeah.
which is amazing. And to be exposed to that, even in like the smallest degree, right? Because yeah. it's not in our everyday life, but to be exposed to that in such a young age is so amazing. And, you know, I feel grateful that I know a lot of great music educators who try their best to do the same.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I'm just going to put out another plug here for all the educators or music enthusiasts to, you know, go wide and go broad mm-hmm. because you never know what beats, what sounds, what traditions are going to influence the people that are listening.
Totally.
Even like the smallest thing can become a domino effect.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, like quite honestly, I don't envy his position where he was trying to like convince the school to like, hey, like give us a bunch of money so we can do this. Like that must have sucked, but he fought so hard for it
yeah.
and it was totally worth it. Oh. Like it was an incredible, like it genuinely like an investment like in the community. Cause like anyone yeah. from anywhere could just come and join this program. You didn't have to be a kid in school. There was, you know, like parents were doing it and like, you know, whatever, people who graduated were coming back and doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just a super like rewarding experience.
Yeah. It makes me feel like, it makes me think of when younger people are more able to learn different languages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you exactly. kind of are like learning different yeah. musical languages at that age.
It's so true. I even just thinking back, like how quickly I was able to learn a like 25 minutes of music when I was in high school. That would take me like 2 weeks. And I'd be like, all right, yeah, let's go do it. Like, and I, like even thinking about having to do that now, like learning like a 40-minute set like on drums, I'm like, oh, shit. I gotta make charts and I gotta, like, yeah.
Well, I will say, you know, going to the neuroscience, you'll find this interesting that when we're preteens and teenagers, mm-hmm. our brains are pruning as rapidly as when we're like babies. Right.
Yeah.
So your brain has like these two huge bursts of when they change the most. And when we're like pre-adolescence and adolescence, that's like the next burst. Mm-hmm. So this is also why we remember so much about like
right.
that time period, because our brains are making these really strong neural connections,
yeah.
which allow for us to learn faster. And it stinks because, you know, just as another plug, as we're getting older, doesn't mean we can't learn new things.
Yeah.
It just means it takes more effort.
I wish I'd learned more back then, you know?
Right? That's a plug for young people too, who might be listening, for all my, you know, high schoolers out there.
Yeah. Go learn some random stuff.
Take it all in. Observe it now, because it will stay with you if you practice it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not saying take stats class, but like learn how to play the piano. You know?
I mean, if it's your thing, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, you never know. I always say stats is like the language of math. You get to tell a story with math and numbers if you're not into math, but... Mm-hmm. But yeah, like learn your skills early, because I go back to the guitar or to learning a new language and I'm like, oh, this is taking me way longer mm-hmm. than it used to.
Yeah.
Not to say I'm old, or any of us are old though.
Yeah. And like you said, exposure to music early on is important. And, I mean, we can think of even the popular music we listened to in high school. Like a friend of mine just... In our group text, we always talk about music, and he's like, yeah, you know, I was just looking at the top 10 TRL songs of 1999, and we were guessing the songs.
We just said we weren't going to age ourselves, Jer.
Yeah. But it becomes ingrained in you, you know, it's an emotional, and it's also part of our identity development in high school. So, you know, the more we can be exposed to, the more our identity could be more expansive. And Mike, I think you're a really good example of just kind of being a well-rounded person and being expansive. Not only as a person, but in your music and the way that you approach music. And it seems like your early experiences really helped you with that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it's, you know, it's important, I think, in this career path, at least, to be able to wear a lot of different hats. At least that's what I've found in my experience. You know, whether it's, can you come fill in for somebody? Our bassist is sick.
Mm.
Can you like learn this music and play on Friday? Like, I've been able to do that because just like, I don't play bass. I don't even like, I barely play guitar, you know, but like you just do it sort of good enough and
yeah,
just don't play outside of your range. And
do you have fun doing it too?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends. If it's something so crazy and I'm like really stressed about the parts, like I'm not going to have as much fun, but
yeah.
I don't think anyone who plays music that difficult would ask me to
do that. Well, I was going to say this at the very beginning, but I have to say, you know, people might be listening and be like, oh, is Mike the best producer at Cybersound? Is that why they're interviewing him? And I will say that, like,
they're all amazing.
They're so amazing. Every single person who works here, huge props, especially to Rob, who is our primary producer on the podcast. And everybody, even Perry, the owner, is a great producer in his own right. But I want to say that, you know, we have you on here to highlight and showcase your skills, but also because you and Jerry have formed a really cool bond over the past, year and a half, 2 years, which is really sweet. And sweet in like a cool, like 90s sweet kind of way.
Sweet bro, yeah.
Right, yeah. Like, yeah, so sweet bro. But I want us to drill down a little bit into like that relationship. And we can use this, you know, we use Jerry and I as an example of pretending I was a patient in his therapy session. But we can use this as an example of, you know, a musician who created his own songs and this idea for how he wanted to produce his songs with a producer. Because I think, you know, a lot of people who are creative and have been writing music, and I think since COVID too, more people have been tapping into things that they might not have done before. And I want us to kind of like pull the curtain back a little bit for people to hear more about what that experience is like. Because just to set the stage, for those of you who don't know, you know, Jerry, I'll let you tell your story about how you picked up a guitar for a second, because I think it will inform how Jerry got to this point of producing with you. But during COVID, you really got back into music because there were, you know, spaces of time that, you know, a lot of us didn't know what to do with, and you channeled it in a productive way. To go back to your creative aspirations of, you know, being a singer-songwriter, not to become a singer-songwriter, I don't think, at the beginning, but to express yourself in that creative way, which is your therapeutic process too, which is really nice. But you know, all of it kind of came to life when you brought your ideas and your music to Mike. And I feel fortunate that I got to sit in on a couple of those sessions and both like hear and see and talk through some of the stuff with Mike and how he makes decisions, and then also knowing you and your process. So it would be really cool for us to pull the curtain back a little bit and talk through that process. And I'm going to say, because I've whispered to Mike before and be like, well, how do you give feedback when you don't want to hurt somebody's feelings, but you know a change needs to be made? Because we want to honor your process and also make it like the best it could be. So don't hold back is my point. Let's really let it all out here. Exactly. Well, that's my point too. Not to be fearful of feedback. Part of learning, as we talk about all the time here, is, you know, taking, receiving, and using feedback to guide us. I think that's where learning happens. So, Mike, we're coming back to you in a second, but Jer, real quick, you know, Mom handed you a guitar at like a really vulnerable moment in our lives when we were going through a lot emotionally when we were younger. I wonder what, if you could just quickly share what music was like for you that got you into learning how to play and eventually write music.
Yeah, I'll try to make this quick because I want to put all the emphasis on Mike for today. But 15 years old, Mom gave me a guitar. I was like, what? I don't know if I want to do that. Obviously, sometimes I like overthink things a little bit. I'm like, whatever. So she got me 2 guitar lessons. And I basically just went to 2 or 3 guitar lessons and then just stopped going to lessons. But I basically just played my entire life on my own.
Yeah.
Just playing around. I never really did anything intensively. I didn't do any training really. I didn't like, you know, we didn't have YouTube back then. I wasn't like looking up YouTube tutorials.
YouTube University.
Yeah, exactly. I think I got my degree from YouTube. Basically just did music on my own privately. And I would write poetry and I would turn into a song. I would play here and there. Our cousin played a little bit of electric guitar.
I'm going to press pause. And I have to emphasize this, and I hope you're okay with me saying this. This was at a time where, you know, Jerry is a deep thinker and didn't always like share and talk so much. And Mom's like, you know what? I think you need to let all this out in a certain way, and handed you a guitar. And I think that was almost like, you know, not that you needed permission to express or share, but that was like a big moment. And I'm saying this because music could be so therapeutic in so many ways. And I want us to tap into that some more too. But I think it's a really important point that like the moment that music kind of struck you as like, oh, I can do this thing, was where you were kind of processing through the experiences we were having as teenagers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have binders still of like just songs I wrote, like this, like hundreds of songs.
It's awesome.
Over the past, like of my life, 40 years old now. So like over the past, you know, since 15. Yeah, I mean, 100% that music is so therapeutic to be able to express yourself in different ways. Like I said, I never did it publicly. And I would only, over the years, and especially during COVID, would start sharing with you and mom and be like, is this okay? What do you think?
And I'm very brutal with feedback. I apologize, Jerry. I was maybe too brutal.
But moms aren't.
Mom's not, no.
She's
honest, but not brutal.
She's honest. Yeah, she's definitely honest, too. I even did the, there's something at the Cape called Poetic License. And it was like for a bunch of people, like on public television, doing like sharing your poetry.
Nice.
And I literally did that online during COVID.
It was very cool. It was very brave. It was very brave.
That was literally the first time I ever did it.
But I really wanted you to share your story because I think it helps to frame how Mike helped you to have more courage and bravery to really bring your music to life in a new way. So starting with like keeping it to yourself, like slowly dripping into sharing it. And then all of a sudden, we just started the podcast. Jerry's like, I think I'm going to look for a studio to record some of my music. And I was like, I know a studio. I'm like, maybe we could record the podcast there too. And then everything just came together, which is really cool. So I don't know if you know that backstory, but I think it's a really interesting progression. And for anybody who's listening, really, you know, the point is for you guys to share your experiences so others might be inspired too. So I appreciate you sharing that, Jared, because I think it's interesting and it bridges into your relationship you've built with Mike as a producer.
Yeah, 100%.
/ instrumentalist on like every other instrument that you don't play that's on your songs.
Which is good.
Let's just say my confidence is boosted by feedback from family and also from Mike. Just to quickly set the stage, the music I make is about therapy because I'm a therapist, I'm a psychologist. And during COVID especially, I started to channel the stories and the emotions of therapy into songs as a way to kind of give back and to kind of give almost like a soundtrack to therapy. It's all positive, inspirational. And my confidence really, really, really boosted when I met Mike because I have no idea what I'm doing. And I would always tell Mike, I don't know what I'm doing. I wasn't trained. But Mike almost like built confidence to be able to see that there is a way to do this. And Alexis, you know, she gave me the suggestion that, you know, why don't you work with someone else to make your music better? And, you know, I had to reframe that.
Not English. That it wasn't.
Exactly. That's why I had to reframe it.
Yeah, but it's true. Yeah.
So, Mike, maybe you can share your experience on the other side of it and to use this as an example of everybody you work with, because I'm sure other people you work with are going to listen in. And I don't want this to be about me necessarily, but about your process. And we can use this as an example about what it's like to bring creative ideas to life.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you are a new artist finding your sound or your voice or whatever, there's always going to be some growing pains. Mm. Not just, you know, from the technical perspective, because recording is like a different skill than a lot of other musical performance situations. But, you know, in finding your ability as a songwriter, your ability as a player, you're going to realize the second you step in front of a microphone, woo, maybe I'm not as good at this as I thought. And that's everybody, though. That's if you've never recorded before, you will instantly realize that, oh, I can hear everything. I have nowhere to hide. Which, you know, to some people can be discouraging at first. But, you know, if you push past that a little bit and you make a couple songs to start or whatever, and you just want to have recordings of them, you kind of realize, oh, okay, well, I was really not so optimistic about this when I first did it, but like listening back to it, this is actually pretty good. Mm. And the first few are always going to be, you know, you hear the struggle in them a little bit, which is true for most people. But, you know, it's like we were saying before, you just keep working at a skill and it gets easier. Recording specifically, like you get used to hearing yourself in the headphones, you get used to a process that works. You know, you start to understand what you should bring me. Like, you should, you know, don't just be like, oh, I have this one lyric, and then show up to the studio. I'm like, great. What do you want to do? Which some people do. And I think that's totally
I
like,
never do that.
You know, I come with a song, which is great. But some people don't. Some people are like, oh yeah, like I had this idea, or I like this song that's already exists. And I'm like,
yeah.
I'm like, I'm down for whatever. I'll make something from nothing if that's what you need me to do. But you know, it's always easier with a vision going into it, yeah. I think.
So at that point, you're kind of a collaborator with someone who brings you that
exactly
smaller idea. Yeah,
yeah, and I think a big part of it too is starting to understand your role in the collaboration. Mm-hmm. Because like, as you know, as any of us who work here will tell you, sometimes you press record and then you sit on your phone for 2 hours and that's the extent of your collaboration. And some people, that's how they operate. They want to really police themselves in the recording process. They don't really want your input. And that's great. There's a lot of people who operate like that. But and then there's the other side where like they want you to tell you, like they want feedback on every tiny little minuscule thing to the point where it's like, I could just talk at you after every take, but which I try to, you know, not do that.
Yeah.
There's a fine line between getting enough takes and getting feedback, which is different for everyone. But yeah, understanding your role like in the collaboration is super important, whether you're actually producing them or whether you're more just engineering. Yeah.
So you what's your process of figuring that out? Because I mean, someone sets up time with you in the studio, right? Mm-hmm. And they show up. I mean, is there kind of like a process you go through to try to figure out what that person needs? Because in some ways, it's a lot of like therapy.
Yeah.
Someone comes mm-hmm. to my therapy appointment, or someone works with Alexis, and part of a huge part of our job is like, what's going on and what do they actually need from our interactions, our communication?
It is exactly the same. That's exactly the same process yeah. where you read the room, feel it out. If they're being receptive to your feedback, awesome. Let's dig in a little more. Let's push it a little farther. If they're being like, okay, whatever, then just back off and just let them do their thing. I've been in both situations where I'm like, if they're asking my opinion about something, I'll gladly give them my opinion, but I won't give, you know, advice they're not asking for, that type of thing. And that's a good relationship where they know what they want. They know whether or not they executed it. And I'm not going to say anything unless they ask. But yeah, you just kind of have to feel it out and like kind of start to, once you get more comfortable together, maybe it's a couple sessions in, whatever, you push the boundary a little more, push it a little more, offer a little more advice. And you have to do it in a way, obviously, where it doesn't seem like you are insisting anything. And, you know, like, I'm sure, like, you guys know this, like you gotta like put like a positive twist on things.
Yeah.
Most of the time, because artists can be very
Humans have egos,
yeah. And like artists can be sensitive about their art. And yeah. it's easy to construe constructive criticism as I'm attacking your art, which is an attack on you.
Mm.
And so like language, yeah, I'm sure it's exactly the same. Language is very important.
Yeah.
And the way you say things is often more important than what you're actually saying.
Oh, so true.
Totally.
That sounds really awesome. That was an awesome quote.
No. Yeah, it was.
That sounded so deep.
No, it's true. It's so important. It's the same thing in teaching. It's yeah. the same thing in Jerry's work too. It's like in any relationship, yeah, right? Yeah. We often don't inhibit enough to like catch ourselves, but mm-hmm. in that interaction, it can make or break your relationship with
yeah.
the artist or with mm-hmm. your work or with anybody in your life.
And you don't really know like what the person's thinking in the first place, which is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, let me give a quick example. I remember when you would record me doing a part of a song and I would listen back and you would make a change to it that I think was like a great change. And we would have interesting conversations about this because in my brain, when I wrote this song, I can hear what I imagine the song to be like. I'm like, oh, this is the shape of the song. This is the melody. This is kind of how it sounds in my head. And then when I played it, recorded on my phone. And when you would make a change to it, it would like qualitatively change it just a little bit. Literally, my brain had to adapt to what that sounded like. And I would literally, you would send it to me, you would bounce the file, send me the MP3, and I would have to listen to the new version of it probably 10 times over and over and over and over and over until it's like, oh, it sounds great. But at first, it's like, oh, wait, what? Even though it was great, I'd be like, oh.
Different. Change is hard.
demoitis. Which is a real thing.
Did you learn that in Berkeley?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
No, did you coin it?
I didn't come up with that, but any producer will tell you, don't get demoitis.
Yeah.
What's your experience with that, you know, in terms of the collaboration process?
Yeah, I mean, it is true. People get very attached to what they have in their heads. I do it too.
Yeah.
I will be producing a track and I'm, you know, whatever. We'll do like a couple versions of it that are completely rough, like unmixed, like no anything, like mistakes in it.
Mm.
And then I finally do the first mix and I'm listening to it. I'm like, why is this like, this part doesn't sound right. I'm like, oh, because you actually played the correct note on the guitar in this part. Like, and then I have to just like retrain my brain to be like, no, that's actually like, yeah, stop thinking about that.
It's so true. It's like, you know, I work with a lot of students who will do the writing, to Jerry's point. Like, they don't always get it out of their head the way they're hearing it thinking about it. And then the same thing is like when you make a little tweak, it takes time to adjust, to be like, oh, this is okay. And I think there's two reasons. It's either one, like, oh, I'm done, I got it out.
Yeah.
Or two, this is good enough, or maybe something else is getting in the way of the process of like continuing on.
Yeah, that's like a big part of what we do as producers. Like, you feel like I'm a translator between your brain and the real world.
Yeah, totally. It's such a skill.
Yeah, and it's something I'm still working on. It's something I'll never stop working on. It's not an easy thing to do, and everyone's different, you know. And I think, like, you know, getting the best way to communicate something like that is through like references to things that already exist. And like, there's a lot of times, like, I find most talking about music, I speak in terms of other things, which, like, sometimes, like, I kind of realize this, that sometimes that can be like a little insulting to people, because they think I'm saying like, oh, this is unoriginal, when in reality I'm saying, no, this is, I'm comparing it to something that already exists to like literally give it a direct line in my brain. And I try to make that very clear, because every time someone will play a demo for me, I'm like, oh, this sounds like this song or like this band. And like, that's meant to be like, oh, like
a compliment.
Yeah, exactly. It's meant to be a compliment. It's meant to show them that the gears are turning and I can understand their vision. And, you know, I will always ask, like, if, you know, I have this specific guitar tone in mind. You're like, oh, I really love John Mayer's live guitar tone. I'm like, okay, sick. That's a great, easy reference for me to pull up and try to emulate that, you know?
But our brains also do better when we have familiarity, right? When there's something that you can associate with, because I think it helps to clarify what the goal is. Because I imagine, you know, humans in general have a hard time clarifying what their goal is.
Mm-hmm.
And that in your work, especially from the creative process, sometimes there isn't a clear goal. It's like, there's these things I want to put together and create. Mm-hmm. And going back to Jerry's question before too, is your process when an artist shows up the same? Like, do you have like a process that you go through as you're starting to make music with people, or is it something that you develop as you get to know the artist over time? Or curious about that.
I try to start kind of in the same place with everybody, but inevitably it is something different for everyone. I mean, it's all variations on the same set of skills, same whatever, but it's in the details of it that's always different.
Yeah.
So like, Jerry, like, we have a pretty good like system for getting the song down, right? Like, we always just do like a cut of acoustic guitar and a cut of vocals, because that's how you wrote the song. So to me, that's the fastest way to get like the purest vision of the song out of your head and into something that I can start working with.
Mm.
But for some people, it's like they'll come in and they say, oh, I just have this chord progression.
Mm.
And sometimes that's all they give me. And I say, all right, let's get a little deeper than that. So before you even like do any arrangement, I'm like, okay, do you have like a specific genre you want it to sound like? Or is there like a specific song you were kind of listening to a lot at the time that you really liked when you came up with it? And sometimes we'll make an entire instrumental before we even record a single vocal, which I don't think is something we've ever really done. We always kind of do the vocals first. And that's also a logistical thing too, of like, if you're trying to get a couple songs done in a session, sometimes that's how you have to do it. Like when I work with bands, you know, we'll do a drum day. Mm. So this requires the songs to be already written and arranged, which I make very clear. I'm like, look, if we're recording 7 tracks of drums, these 7 songs better be written already, because otherwise we're going to have a really bad time later down the line. Mm. And I'm not setting all this crap up again. I mean, I will.
Of course,
forever,
but it's,
you know.
Yeah.
But it requires planning is what you're saying.
It requires planning or
not
you're going to be over budget.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and then it's, yeah, the logistics of it are interesting too, because obviously like in a commercial facility like this, I can't just leave a drum set up in this room for 5 days. Mm-hmm. Like if I could, I absolutely would. But so it's something you have to plan around, and that is, it's going to depend on the person you're working with.
Well, it's interesting because your first initiation with someone might be that they just show up and mm-hmm. there's no pre-discussion about what they're bringing to you necessarily. So it's interesting. So what advice would you give to an artist who might use a studio if they've never met a producer before?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like when we met, it was just kind of like, oh, you showed up and like we got to know each other and I'd seen you around and stuff. And then we started talking and figuring it out. But like now, if it's especially like a young singer-songwriter, I try to be like, hey, like, give me a call tomorrow and we'll talk about what you want to do before I even like book time with them or anything. Just to like, not only like for me to understand what they want to do, but to like kind of set their expectations as well of like what's possible. Because that, if you've never set foot in this environment before, your expectations are going to vary wildly.
Yeah.
Some people are like, oh, it's going to take like 8 hours to record like the guitar. And it's like, no, like it'll probably take like 40 minutes. But
unless they're learning to play guitar while they're recording.
Yeah. And depending on who it is, I might be like, hey, do you want me to just do that real quick? Or I'm like, I'm happy to let you figure it out.
And yeah.
Because
yeah.
Whatever. But like,
to each their own.
Yeah, to each their own. I like to kind of chat with people about what's going on. And you know, if like I want to know people's budget, I want to know people's timeline, I want to know their expectations of what's going to happen. And I just like to just get to know them a little bit and have a conversation with them, so I can even just like having a phone call with them, and you can kind of feel out their like yeah. energy a little bit. If they're like super like neurotic and like really like controlling, like you will get that, you will immediately get that on the phone. Mm. Or if they're really cool and laid back and I just want to make my album, man. Like, that's great too.
It's very executive function of you. Like, take stock, plan it out, yeah. Do a little preview,
think about
timing.
A,
well, that was actually another question I have, because, and we'll dive into kind of like the producing and yeah. editing piece of things, because do you think it requires a producer to have a little bit of a perfectionistic personality and quality to be a really good producer?
Yeah,
I think some people would say that, and I think some people would argue the opposite.
Mm.
If it sounds good, it is good. I don't know. Like it's. I understand it's very hard sometimes to something you've made be like, it is now done. Yeah. That is nearly impossible to do in anything.
Anything.
And be like, this is the final product. Mm. I'm going to give it to the world now. Like that is an impossible task most of the time. And so I think, From a technical perspective, like obviously like there's a little perfectionist in me, there's a little perfectionist in everyone, I think, to a degree.
Yeah.
But you have to know like just when to shut it off.
Yes.
And sometimes it's shut off by budget or by time constraint.
Mm.
And so in that case, like when you know you're working like on the clock, like under the gun, like this has to be done by whatever, 2 days from now, it's just priorities.
Mm.
Is the vocal good? That's step one for like most stuff. Like,
yeah.
Is the vocal performance good? Great. Are the drums good? Great. Is everything else good? Great. Master it, ship it, done.
Yeah.
And you just don't want to let it, you don't want to get carried away. It's so easy now. It's so easy. Back in the 70s and 80s when everything was on tape, sorry, that's the take we have.
Mm-hmm.
It's either this or we spend $50,000 to re-record the record. Like,
yeah.
That's such a good point.
Yeah, it was so much harder, and which also forced musicians to be a lot better. You assembled the Wrecking Crew to do every one of your songs, because you know they could come in 2 hours the song will be done. And that's all just about budget and technology. And now with Pro Tools, I could go into a song you released 2 years ago and make the third note of the second chorus 5 cents sharper, and you could re-release it. And like, that's too much power. That's too much power that like you shouldn't be able to do that.
we're going to be, we already did a perfectionist episode. We're going to do another one with an expert who wrote a book about it. And one of the things that we really emphasized in our episode was, with so much information, and as you said, power, I think it's a good word. It makes us, it's almost like analysis paralysis, like, or decision-making paralysis. There's too many choices, and we get paralyzed by having too many choices. Mm-hmm. With so much information on the internet, I think it feeds into the perfectionism, because you feel like there's no limits and there's no boundaries. And it requires us, as you're saying, like, you know, in terms of executive functioning, you're suggesting to offset that, sometimes we have to create structure and boundaries around, this is the best we can do, and let's be clear about what is the best we can do. I think sometimes helping people with perfectionism is actually having clarity. Okay, here's kind of what we're aiming for, and let's try to aim for something at least close to that.
Yeah.
Therefore, we know what's good enough. And sometimes when there's so much information, so much power, people have no idea what's good enough. They're like, I don't know. Can I be like Steph Curry and make 5,000 three-pointers in a row?
Yeah, and that's, like I was saying before, that kind of falls to me sometimes to understand the priorities. And that depends on the artist. It depends on the band. And like, yeah, if it's a band that's tracking live, I'm like, all right, do you guys sound tight together? If the answer is no, then we're doing two takes and I'm spending the rest of the session editing, because I know you're not going to be able to play the way I need you to play. Whereas sometimes it's like, oh, they sound really good. We have a whole session left. Let's get two more takes of the full song, because you guys are really starting to feel it. And that's going to be the most productive use of the time. Yeah, and it depends on the skill level. It depends. Yeah, it just depends on all the stuff we've been talking about.
Every time I see anything on social media that talks about like boredom and creativity, I joke and I'm like, oh, I just need to be bored to like let, I crave boredom actually. Mm-hmm. Would you give any advice to artists that are out there that want to perform about boredom and creativity and even preparation before you go in to start recording?
I mean, I'm the most creative when I'm bored.
Me
definitely
too.
Like, and it's also, I'm in a weird position. I mean, like, if you do this kind of work, I think it's very hard to want to work on your own music after you've been working on other people's music all week.
Yeah.
Like, and like, not that that's a bad thing necessarily, but it's like depletes you a little bit. Whereas like, if I have like a day off, I'm like, oh, I gotta freaking do something or I'm gonna go insane. And so like, that's kind of the points when I get the motivation to like sit down and just like make some stupid riff or something and just get something like out of my mind, just so I feel like I was productive.
Yeah, it's so interesting how that happens. I think I'm the same way. Like the work like fuels me because I love what I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But then when I have those moments of creativity, it either like, sometimes for me, it actually overwhelms me because I'm like, oh, now I got to do something with this. This could be good.
Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, I really should like go grocery shopping and do laundry and watch TV for once. But I'm going to sit in front of Pro Tools for 6 hours. Like,
yeah, well, I mean, it's well, that's also the difficulty, right? Is when like your job becomes your life, but it's not, like, I don't see this as a negative. It's almost like it becomes like a purposeful piece of your world and your existence, which is so cool because it also inspires the people you work with and vice versa. Mm-hmm.
Well, something you said too, Mike, that relates to what Alexis is saying is that you sometimes recommend, hey, Jared, like, listen to the song and just spend like a couple days just kind of sitting with it. And you know, I feel
sit
like...
with it.
Sip my song.
My
song.
Good plug.
That was non-intentional. But you can see where the creativity of my songs comes from. So, to actually just pull back from that kind of grind, right, is actually something that we need to intentionally do. Like yesterday, the weather was so nice. I'm like, let me just go for a walk during my break, and I went to one of those calmer, you know, Newbury Street could be pretty busy. So I went to Calm Ave, which I call Calm Ave, C-A-L-M, even though it's Calm Ave. And I went to another street that's even calmer. So there's nobody around. It's cobblestone, beautiful little area. The sun was shining. I literally just stood there. Nobody was around. And I just stood there. And I had some song ideas actually come to me. I wasn't planning on it. But I think sometimes, like you said, when we can constantly have so much power to keep doing things and doing things and doing things, it's like we need to create rituals for ourselves to step out of that kind of matrix of just productivity and allow that stuff to happen. Even within our sessions, Mike.
Yeah.
I want to give you a compliment too. You have no ego when we work together.
That's good.
And I think I'm never thinking to myself, oh, Mike is worried about him and his ego. He's all about getting into the song and figuring it out.
That's awesome.
And I really, really appreciate that about you. It really feels like a collaboration and like we're in tune with each other. I feel like you're really in tune with what we're doing. It feels right. It feels like it's the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if it's not serving the song, why are we doing it? Is sort of a good philosophy. Like even with suggestions people make, sometimes they're like, oh, like let's add a accordion and a flute. And I'm like... You got to know and just be like, no, dude, like, what are you talking about?
But if they want...
I would get that. I would make that happen somehow. But like, yeah, I want to pretend it's some like higher like calling being like, everything is like should serve the song. It's like not that crazy, but like, should though.
Yeah, it's your authenticity, your professionalism, and your care. It's apparent. It's cool.
Yeah, and you're not like trying to prove anything in terms of like what you're capable of. You're just trying to do what makes sense and what's right for the song, which I really appreciate. You know, like if I brought the accordion, you wouldn't be like, all right, I got to prove that I can bring a solo accordion into your song.
No, it's not working. I'm gonna delete it.
Well, I think that's the thing too. In thinking about feedback, like if something's not working, you will share that, and ultimately, I guess it's the artist. Choice whether or
of
not
course.
To keep it or not.
Yeah.
Which is that hard for you? Because I know sometimes, like, I don't know, for me in my own work, sometimes I'm like, oh, is that a good idea in my head? Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking, okay, what's the right way of approaching this?
Yeah. I mean, like every other answer I've given, it depends.
Yeah, totally.
Mean, some people are, like I said, a lot more receptive to that feedback and trusting in me being like, hey, like, I know you want to spend 6 hours adding the hammered dulcimer to this song, but I already know it's going to sound terrible.
But we just need more cowbell, Mike.
But at the end of the day, like, that's the other position I'm in, right? You're paying me. Yeah. At the end of the day, it is your call.
Yes.
I will advise you. I'm like a lawyer. I'll advise you, but if at the end of the day you want to go testify in court, then that's up to you, man. Like, people always wonder too, like, oh, have you ever worked on something that's like so bad that you don't want your name on it? And like, I find like very rarely does that happen where like, I mean, I always present my case. I'm like, look, even when it's like something as trivial as like, I'm like mixing a song for someone.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh yeah, I want like the sub to be like way louder or whatever. And I'm like, look, I'll gladly make the sub way louder for you. But I'm telling you, it's... not the song overall, it's going to lose a bunch of headroom. It's not going to sound as loud and it's going to sound really muddy and terrible.
Yeah.
I'll do it.
Yeah.
And obviously like, I don't feel like that's something crazy enough where I would like be like, take my name off this. But there have been projects where I'm like, hey, I don't think we have the same vision for what this should be. I'm happy to do whatever you want me to do, but I think you should probably find someone else to work with because I either there's just like a fundamental like difference in the way we work, which has happened.
Yeah.
And that's totally fine. Everyone works differently. And I'm not going to try to like keep you like desperately.
No ego.
Yeah, yeah. But I think
that's
it's also
great.
Important because as like smooth as you guys have been describing your collaborations, which is wonderful, there's also the other side of it when it doesn't work. And I think that's ultimately like the most important thing is to be honest. Like, hey,
this
isn't working. Because I think, you know, a lot of time and energy and resources can get wasted where they might be used differently.
Right, right. And I feel like I can always kind of figure out someone's personality and like the way they want to work.
Yeah.
But it's like when you're actually implementing that, it can be a lot different because you start to like actually get into the weeds of like creating something.
Yeah.
And sometimes not even that like they're doing it in a weird way. It's a way that totally makes sense to them, but a way that like my brain can just not like literally cannot comprehend why they would do something this way.
Yeah.
And that's fine. And that works great for people.
I think especially with music, like so many things in life, like there's a niche that sometimes other people can connect to a thing that maybe the majority isn't. And there's a place for it, but maybe it doesn't always click or connect with everybody all the time. And I'm just going to put it out there. That's okay. Right.
That's okay. Like, and that's some of the coolest music I've ever heard is stuff that I'm like, how would you even come up with this? Like, maybe my brain is too like process focused sometimes and a little like, I find myself honing in on the technical aspect of stuff sometimes a little too much.
Yeah.
And the like, yeah, I just, I don't know, I get tunnel vision on stuff sometimes, but like, I've had clients that are like, okay, yeah, like we do a song or whatever. And they're like, yeah, this is cool. And then like 6 months later, they're like, oh yeah, like I just recorded this like in my friend's basement. And it's like the weirdest, coolest thing I've ever heard. And I'm like, I totally get why I would never make anything like this. Yeah. I'm glad like they were able to like find someone that will do like weird stuff with them.
Well, I think that's the hardest thing about creativity is that you often can't like press a button and turn it on.
Yeah,
right? Like somebody might like book time in the studio and be like, oh, that's my time to create or put these pieces together. Mm-hmm. But like, it might not be the right time to pull it all together. So I think that's also so important to give space and time to find the flow and see what makes sense. And not just for music, I think for anything when we think about it, when we pull back a little bit, sometimes we can see things differently, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting when I'm on the clock and I'm put in that position too. I find oftentimes the like there will be days I'm just like drained. I'm like, I just like I've been like making stuff for people all day. And then someone comes in, they're like, oh, can we like make something? And I'm like, okay. Like but I don't know, the like like to be very honest, the fact that I'm getting paid for it is a great motivator. It's a great motivator to like want to just like, all right, two more hours of like focus and then I can go collapse on my bed. Like it definitely does help. Not to say that it works out every time. I have days when like someone comes in and like, oh, we'll just like make an instrumental today and we'll see what happens. And we make some, we're just like, I don't know. It's like, it's fine, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's just like not very good sometimes.
Yeah, but I think that's also like the foundational skills you've built allow for you, even when you're tired or not feeling the flow, to be able to put pieces together, whether or not it comes out exactly the way you want it to or not. I think that's an amazing thing.
I have a question that's a kind of a piggybacking off of your conversation you just had about songs and like the quality of songs. You may not be able to answer this question. What makes a great song?
Oh, here's something crazy I'll say. Certainly not the mix and master, that's for sure. Controversial maybe, but
I think about that often.
Explain what you mean to someone who's not familiar with what you mean by that.
So like as I sort of like hang out with songwriters more and more, I totally realize that if the song is good, it's good. The whole thing is good. I'm sure a lot of people's favorite songs, they don't even realize that like the technical quality of the recording isn't good. Like a good example I always bring up, right, is like Californication, Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah.
That's like one of the most popular albums of all time. That album sounds so awful, it is unbelievable.
Wow.
It is literally painful to listen to for me because it was like the dawn of like the digital age. And so they're like, oh, we can just like keep making it louder and louder and louder. And it's just distorted and sounds terrible and sounds like it was recorded in a trash can. But no one's ever noticed that before. I mean, unless you like do this kind of stuff, you don't really notice it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, these songs are awesome. Yeah. And I feel the energy of the performance and Flea's crazy and like, and the parts are really good, but that's it. And if that, quite honestly, if the album was recorded any other way, I don't think it would be as good.
I think it's the same when you go, to like a live rock show.
Yeah.
Like oftentimes you lose some of the lyrics in the sound, right? And it's more about the experience of it all together.
Exactly. Like I've done front of house. There's no way that singer that's whispering is getting past that wall of four guitars. Like it's just not happening.
Right. In thinking about what's next, what's something about music or production that you're really excited about that's kind of like starting to percolate or happen more now that you see going on? Curious of your thoughts?
That's a crazy question. I mean, it's definitely like an interesting time right now in the industry.
Yeah.
There's a lot of big shifts, like, I don't know, like away from the whole like, oh, like I want to be in a band that gets signed. Like maybe some people want that, but it's like, I don't know. I don't really think with young people, that's like a thing anymore.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
I mean, I'm sure some people still, that's like the goal they have, but like, it's not really all it used to be.
Things aren't music, I think, is not that corporate anymore, or maybe doesn't. Is that, need to be, maybe.
Well, is that why you were suggesting it's important as a if you want to have a career in music to be versatile, to be able to, you know, have different types of income and different types of ways of making money? I hear that a lot from the musicians I work with.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, I think specifically in like production, it's like, yeah, production is great and it is like, you know, like my primary source of income, but like I play gigs, I fill in for people and I make money doing that. And
some people teach.
Yeah, so yeah, you could teach.
A lot of people do that.
You can do like arrangement. You can write charts. You can do like, yeah, like live sound stuff, like installation sound. There's all sorts of stuff.
Somebody was telling me that even like high school bands need someone to create compositions for what they're playing, right?
Yeah. And I've like done stuff like that. I taught, you know, like marching band for a couple of years when I was out of high school.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and that was fun. And, you know, you get to kind of do some of the music and stuff and rearrange things and all that. But yeah, the versatility is, it's important, you know, because sometimes things just stop happening. Like, especially like in the winter, like, nobody wants to play gigs in the winter. It's cold. So
nobody wants to do much of anything.
Exactly.
Especially in New England, yeah.
Yeah, nobody wants to go out and like play outdoor venue, like out night, like, you know. In the summer, we always play like breweries and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that's like, they pay you pretty good. That's awesome. But in the winter, it's a slog.
Yeah. Okay. So anything that is exciting for you right now going into this next phase of whatever music is going to become now that things are so technical, we have so many points of access to tweaking and improving and creating.
I mean, yeah, I can only really speak for like myself, but, and like my, I don't know. It's one of those things like I'm always learning. I'm always like refining my process. I'm always changing my process. We all are. Like that's
totally
what we do as like engineers and producers. We find ways to do things differently. We find something that really like, oh, I really like doing this now.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm trying to do like the less is more thing.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think that comes with experience and time though too, right?
It does, yeah.
Like the more comfortable you get doing the thing, the more you realize you don't have to do so much to make things good.
Yeah, you realize what works and you have a bigger picture to think clearly.
Yeah. And I'm definitely shifting like to trying to get better, like, you know, because you can always like get a good recording, like a whatever recording, and then fix it in the mix, as they say.
Yeah.
I'm just like focusing my like, you know, whether it's like buying microphones or whatever, and like, or just like learning new skills. I'm really focusing on like getting like better recordings because I think it's just way easier to get things to sound good. You don't have to like endlessly process stuff if you have like, you know, like I literally bought like some microphones specifically for doing like acoustic guitar. And even just like having those, I'm like, oh wow, there's like already a big difference in like the way that I'm approaching recording guitars now. And it's like improved the sounds, or in my opinion, it's improved the sounds that I'm searching for.
I want to ask you a cool question.
Yeah.
Mike, what's your favorite Jerpy song?
Ooh, this is a great question. Well, right now I have Sit With It stuck in my head because we were just talking about it before.
Sit With It.
I also like, for some reason, very partial to like Welcome to the Future. I don't know. I just think it's like
speaking
such a great
of AI,
it's a great
technology
concept for a song, and I just thought it was like,
yeah,
it was just a groovy tune. I don't know.
Yeah, it is a fun one.
And then I know I said this last time, the Christmas one. The
Christmas love song.
Christmas love song that we did with Maddie.
Maddie's the best.
Without fail, that song will end up in my head like randomly. Like, oh, it's so good.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'd say like those are like, could be like top three for me.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And thank you for bringing Maddie on to sing the songs. I mean, your idea of like, oh, let's bring in this vocalist and Maddie Donahue has been like an incredible addition.
Yeah, definitely.
And I'll never forget what she said because like I kept producing more and more songs because I got so into it. And she goes, Jerry never gives up. I'm like, I don't know how to interpret that. Do you mean it's not good and I keep trying or I'm getting better?
That could mean I made her do 20 takes of one ooh and she was mad at me. Is what that could mean.
But I think that's a good, it's a testament to the relationship. And like, you actually become a coach, not just like the production side of things. Like, you're coaching and guiding and supporting the process and the artists and all of it. I think it's such a cool thing.
Yeah. I'm a little bit of a therapist.
Yes,
in
you
some
sure
ways.
Are.
People will, they love to vent.
Oh my
but
gosh.
I love to know. I'm like, all right, is this a true story? What's the song?
What's the tea?
Yeah. I get nosy.
What's the reason behind
people
this?
People open up a little more.
You can dive into the song yourself.
Exactly.
But I think like most things, again, it comes down to the relationship. It comes down to the confidence you have in your skills to be able to bring it into what you're doing every day. And there's so many different directions that we could have gone in today and so much more we could still talk about. But, you know, I guess I have one last question and Jerry might have another one too. If you were to give advice to anybody creating anything musical who would want to produce it, what would you share?
Oh, I mean, you got to make 1,000 bad songs before you make a good song. Is like a pretty good place to start.
Yeah.
You have to just keep creating. I don't know. That's as specific as I can be. Like songwriting in particular, you have to like write a lot of bad lyrics. You have to make a lot of really crappy beats before you're going to make one that's like, oh, actually, this is kind of cool. And that's why we all have folders upon folders upon folders of just like Untitled 1, Untitled 2, Untitled 474. Like, that I will never show anybody because they're atrocious. But they exist. And that was what it took to kind of get some confidence in the process.
It's kind of like life too, right? There's just different chapters and different phases that play out in different ways.
You know, it's funny though, and you never know what other people might like too. I remember John Mayer once said that his second album, Heavier Things, it's one that Daughters is on. And so he said that he didn't think Daughters was going to be a very popular song. He didn't want it to be his single, but it turned out that that's the song that everybody absolutely loved, is Daughters. And I think he won an award for it or something like that. So yeah, you just never know. And even some bad ideas could become good ideas if they evolve. I mean, I feel like...
Or if Mike helps to translate them.
Exactly. You just never know. Like sometimes the idea is half-baked and you still have to allow the idea to kind of take shape in a different way, I think.
Yeah. Well, Mike, we are grateful for you and everybody here at Cybersound Studios in Copley Plaza in Boston, Massachusetts. thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for sharing your expertise and your passion. And keep creating. Just inspire so many people who come through these doors, as do the other producers. But we're grateful for you to share a piece of that today.
Thank you guys so much for having me on.
Yeah, thank you, Mike.
Thanks, man.
So important in people's lives. I hope you realize that.
Oh, thank you.
It's really you make a huge difference. Very positive. Thanks for tuning in to the Reed Connected podcast. Please remember that this is a podcast intended to educate and share ideas, but it is not a substitute for professional care that may be beneficial to you at different points of your life. If you are in need of support, please contact your primary care physician, local hospital, educational institution, or support staff at your place of employment to seek out referrals for what may be most helpful for you. Ideas shared here have been shaped by many years of training, incredible mentors, research, theory, evidence-based practices, and our work with individuals over the years. But it's not intended to represent opinions of those we work with or who we are affiliated with. The Reconnected podcast is hosted by siblings Alexis Reed and Dr. Gerald Reed. Original music is written and recorded by Gerald Reed. Editing and recording was done by Cybersound Studios. If you want to follow along on this journey with us, the Reconnected podcast will be releasing new episodes every 2 weeks each season. So please subscribe for updates and notifications. Feel free to also follow us on Instagram at Reed Connected Podcast. That's Reed Connect Ed Podcast, and Twitter at Reed Connect Ed. We are grateful for you joining us and look forward to future episodes. In the meanwhile, be curious, be open, and be well.